Time for Sports Lit 101. Bruce Pratt joining us, and we're happy to welcome back to the program gentleman who's been on with us before. He is the former Poet Laureate of North Carolina, and Bruce, not so sure about having him back because he brought back unpleasant memories of Bill Mazeroski beating his Yankees, but I think it's okay to have him back on because I have to remind him the Maine Black Bear football team is 2-0 at Boone, North Carolina all time. Joe Bethanti is joining us. Joe, welcome back.
Hey, my pleasure. It's good to be with y'all, and I appreciate the sense of humor, too.
Well, you know, Joe, Bruce is still scarred from that 1960 World Series.
Well, I run into a lot of kids my age who were watching that year. And you know, it only occurred to me much later in life that as ecstatic as I was, there were a lot of dejected and near suicidal little Yankee kids that day.
Well, you know, what's funny is that I really wanted the Yankees to win, and we all know what a weird series that was, the Yankees killing the Pirates when they won and being beaten by a little bit when they lost. But there were so many people on that Pirates team, that Dick Groat, Bob Friend, Elroy Face, people that Smokey Burgess, people that to me were hard to dislike. You know, I mean, I couldn't really dislike them. I wanted to win, but I couldn't really dislike them because they were appealing players.
Yeah. It was a crew of almost, Bob Skinner, people like that, folks that no one had really heard of, Gino Cimoli, Gene Baker, Dick Stewart. Of course, Roberto Clemente was on that team, and Vernon Law had won the Cy Young that year. I was in second grade when that happened, but I was already kind of a, you know, madhouse Pirate fan, and Clemente and Mazeroski were my favorite players, so I couldn't quite get over that Maz, batting eighth, a second baseman, a very, very quiet, unassuming fellow, son of a, you know, Polish coal miner from West Virginia, Catholic boy like me, that of all people, you know, he was not a home run hitter, although in 59 he hit 19, which was the most ever, that Maz would pop it out of there. It's still, I think, the most, well, I guess it would vie with Franco's immaculate reception for the most iconic moment in Pittsburgh sports history.
I was watching MLB Network a couple of weeks ago, and they were replaying. It was an old piece on 70s baseball, but a lot of it involved Roberto Clemente, and I was, oh, gosh, what would I have been, 12, 13 in the 71 World Series when they were playing. But he had always been one of my favorite players. But having that national stage in 1971 to show, even, you know, what was he, 35, 36 then, but to show the grace and the talent that he had, he's to me one of those guys who, yeah, he's in the Hall of Fame, but I'm not sure he ever really got his due as great a player as he was, not just offensively, but defensively.
Yeah. And, you know, my dad, I always like to say that I probably saw more major league games than any other kid with my dad at Forbes Field because it was a neighborhood park. You know, it wasn't such a big darn deal to get into a ball game. You know, working class people could afford it. We'd sit either for a buck in the bleachers or really splurge for a buck and a half and sit in general admission. And, you know, and then around the fifth inning, you'd sneak down into the box seat. So I saw those people. I saw Clemente play a lot of ball games and saw some really extraordinary things that he did. And for my money, and I like to exaggerate, I love hyperbole when it comes to sports, of course. I mean, I don't think anyone ever had a better arm than Clemente had. I mean, just period. So.
Yeah, and I saw him a long time because I was in college during that World Series you were just talking about. And I was thinking about, there's an iconic photograph of Clemente making a shoestring catch somewhere in my memory. And I was thinking about poetry and iconic moments like that, and how we all have some picture in our mind. It could be for Pittsburgh, the Immaculate Reception. It could be for, you know, any number of sports. For me, it's Stéphane Matteau stuffing back the goal that's going to eventually help the Rangers get to their first Stanley Cup. How do you think it is that we remember these iconic moments differently in poetry than we do in film or stills or movies?
You know, I think that Robert Lowell has this great line in one of his poems that says, My memory economizes so prodigally, I think I've suffered theft. And I think what he meant by that is the fact that we misremember, we over-romanticize, we end up remembering what we remember rather than the actual event. And as it builds over the years, it becomes more and more important, more and more iconic. So I think we do tend to kind of invent it in beautiful ways. You know, Henry Aaron, of course, just died. And there's another person that I was so enchanted with and saw him hit an extraordinary home run in Forbes Field over the exit gate. And there's a story that I don't know if I read or invented about Henry Aaron blooping one into right field in Forbes Field, and it lands kind of between Clement Mazeroski at second and Clemente. And Clemente didn't go after the ball. He just let it lie there, kind of daring Henry Aaron to take the extra base. And Aaron took off for second, and Clemente, like, darted for the ball and gunned him down at second. Now, I mean, did that happen? I've written about it. I think about it all the time. But I really have no, you know, I don't have any real proof that something like that happened. So I do think that that film tends to over sentimentalize things when in sports often in ways that are egregious, and I do think maybe the written word gets more documentary. You lose language in film, and you're left with images. You know, cinema's extraordinary, but if I really want to go back and see films of iconic sports moments, you know, I can go back and look at YouTube. I can watch Jackie Robinson steal that home in the series against the Yankees in the 40s, I think it was, and slide right under Barra's glove. So I you can't do the same thing with literature reinvents it in ways that film doesn't, I think.
Well, can we hear some of what you've written, what you wrote about Maz and that, you know, iconic moment?
Yeah. I was talking to Bruce. I have a new poem about that, and I've written so much about Mazeroski. I've written, and this might be something worth saying. You know, I've written. I recount that home run in a novel. I have poems about it, and I've also written an essay about it too. So it's kind of something that I cannibalize over and over again. So this is one that I wrote in April of 2019. It's called Litany for Those Awaiting Bill Mazeroski at Home Plate after his home run to beat the Yankees in the 1960 World Series. And it's a poem, but it's a prose poem too. So let me read it, and I call it a litany because I grew up very Catholic, and there are litanies, blessed be, they start, and I was always carried away by that language. So, again, here's the poem, the prose poem. Blessed be the millwrights on the open hearth that awaited him, the nurses and elevator operators, secretaries, plumbers, electricities, the Napolitan and Abruzzese women hunched in sweatshops, merchants, butchers, barbers, pipe fitters, sheet metal workers, tailors, chefs, poets, dancers, singers, painters, the sausage maker, Italians and Jews, Poles, blacks and Germans, Slovaks, those along the rivers and precipices, the usher, barman, stonecutters, bricklayers, bakers, salt crew, dock workers, ditch dogs, rummies, cops and firemen, the women who sliced chipped ham and scooped coleslaw at Isley's in East Liberty, Rose Maggio at Fashion Hosiery on Highland Avenue, the waitresses at Gammon's, Rose at Tootie's, Francine Renzo at Sears and Roebuck Candy Counter, Rita Sweeney at the Suicide King, Harry Eldridge, the greasy red rag in his pocket, the little box that said Harry on his shirt, my dad, a camel between his lips, leaning out the Rambler's window, the words, couple of dollars, a good golf, Harry, smoking out of his mouth, Cigar Sam and union meetings, the Braddock local, Joe the milkman, Pete's in his ice cream truck, the go-go girls at House of Capri across the street from our duplex, the hobos, the beat and broke and pissed, carpenters, cooks, janitors, sweet sweepers, bookies, stiffs, pimps, morticians, junkies, priests, prostitutes, vets with no legs and tin cups on Penn Avenue, leaning against Kresge's window, blind guys you gave a penny, and they gave you a pencil, garbage men who jumped off skidding trucks in dead winter, spread their tarps on the grass and emptied 55-gallon barrels of filth into them, hoisted the bundles, then trudged righteously into the morning. Mrs. Tomarello, who handed me any cookie I pointed to in Stagno's Bakery, blessed be Sister Carita, the only nun who loved me, dear, beautiful girl strangling in her wimple, who led the class daily in prayer that the Pirates defeat the Yankees, that Kennedy defeat Nixon, the crows lining with telephone wires, calling out as he crossed the plate. So, there's one.
Wow.
That's fabulous, John.
That is wonderful.
Oh, thank you. Thanks.
You know, it reminds, there's another poet of Pittsburgh, Terrence Hayes, who has that great...
Oh, yeah, sure.
...about Pittsburgh. You know, Pittsburgh... Pittsburgh is this, Pittsburgh is that. I just think it's so remarkable that two people from such different backgrounds found and invested in Pittsburgh the same things around different incidents. That's a fabulous poem.
Well, thank you. And I know Terrence and I know his work, and I love it. I don't know if there's something in the ether in Pittsburgh, you know, that hard-headed attachment to place and mythos, but I know a lot of Pittsburgh poets, and a lot of them use that place to break off poems and I don't know authenticate everything they write. It's the names of things. It's lovely to just call names sometimes.
Where is your ode to Rennie Stennett, though, Joe?
I remember Rennie Stennett. I do. I left Pittsburgh in 76, so I was not quite as maniacal about the Pirates. Really, once I got to be maybe 13 or so, I wasn't quite as crazy about them. And then they moved to Three Rivers in 71, of course. I mentioned Henry Aaron. I was at the 1974 All-Star Game in Pittsburgh, and it was right after Aaron, a couple months after Aaron broke Babe Ruth's record, and I have never, ever seen a louder, more protracted, ongoing ovation for anybody in my life. It went, when he came to bat in the All-Star Game, it went on and on and on and on. If there's time, I have another baseball poem I could read, but I know we're getting kind of close to probably wrapping up. I think you guys...
We always have time for one more, Joe. Please do.
Yeah, because it would be lovely to end with a poem. This is very much a Pittsburgh poem about, basically my first Little League game. In my neighborhood of East Liberty, which was a Catholic working class neighborhood, mixed race, but still all of the dysfunction of racial antipathy between the whites and the blacks. So this one is called Larmer Field. And my dad was my baseball coach, by the way. So again, here's Larmer Field. Before every game, before they hit us infield, the coaches yelled, "Line up." Both teams, 28 little leaguers, formed a skirmish from the plate. down the left field line until it ended at the Cyclone fence on Lenora Street, where the old Abruzzese, who didn't speak English and didn't know baseball except DiMaggio, sat on their porches and watched us play. Behind them plummeted Bassa Lavallone. We called it the Hollow, the Negley-run boulevard, separating like a DMZ the Harriet Tubman projects from Collins Avenue, the blacks from the Italians. Slowly, we combed Larmer Field, black and hard, rolled with oil to keep down the filth for rocks and broken glass we dropped in our caps. Come dark after the games, prophets gathered and smashed Iron City courts and Sweet Tokay. Poor boys took dopes, left their needles and rubbers in the field. Across the avenue listed Larmer Elementary, built in 1896, where the black children went to school. My sister and I attended Saints Peter and Paul, two blocks down beside the East Liberty Library. German nuns taught there, Sisters of Divine Providence. Playing baseball, I wasn't made to lie or quaver. I understood the distance between bases, mound to plate, circles and squares, a giant diamond, the long chalk line blazing white, blazing green. The Larmer Field was a cinder. Such geometry, the glory of Old Testament, Shakespearean binaries, fair, foul, safe out. Beyond the infield hovered dreamland, the ball assumed, round tripper, hallucinatory, home run evanesced into ether, its occultation of the moon. In visions, I had witnessed myself crouched in the box, my first at bat in heavy flannels, number one, 8 years old, a 29-inch Adirondack in my hands, make the sign of the cross, swing at that first good strike and lift it over the ancient brick wall and right. Over Costa's store, Joseph Street, cleared a distant Larmer Bridge, then float base to base, finally crossing home, coveting not laurels, but solitude, indemnified, debts paid, ledger spotless. There was that kind of clarity. But I was duped, punked, down on Larmer, avenue of parables and epic falls from grace, Frank Latin pitched. I'd heard all about him, skeletal, all the more cockstrong for it, 46 feet away, 12 years old, freak speed coursing blue veins, blue acne, mustache of 50 black hairs. Everybody was afraid of him, contorting like a headsman into his windup, over the top, thunderbolt, guillotine, devouring, decapitating himself as he fired like Juan Marichal, who would one day lay open John Roseborough's skull with a baseball bat. On its axis of red seams, the pristine white Rawlings whirled at my head, faster than anything I'd ever seen, meant to assassinate then and there what I would later record, how it all started that May night, 1962, on Larmer Field. Latin burned three fastballs by me, auguring every harrow to come. The 20th century coursed in on lightning, echoed in Alan Grasso's catcher's mitt. Levitical Bucky Williams, plate umpire, Negro League star, Union millwright, who worked with my father on the open hearth at Edgar Thompson Steele, threw up his fist for the third time, keening as if from a pulpit in the voice of St. Benedict the Moor. I was punched out without even cutting. I turned to him in disbelief, blue blouse, chest protector, his indicator clicking the trinity of strikes, pig iron glare through the bars of his mask. I didn't know if I should thank him. Wasn't someone always nattering, "What do you say? What do you say?" after Sister Geralda beat the shit out of me? I was drilled to peel off her table, turn and say, "Thank you, sister."
Wow.
Good job.
Well, thank you.
And I can, I could smell it. My old leather glove during
that.
When
you read these things, you know, when you read them aloud, you know, you realize how neurotically obsessive you are in all these kind of preoccupations. I've always conflated baseball and Jesus and the nuns and religion and all that. I think because I was kind of an acolyte in both both religions at the same time, you know, Catholicism and baseball.
Well, that was wonderful. Joe, it's great to have you back on with us. Again,
you guys are nice to have me, man. I really appreciate it.
Check out Joe's work, his books, East Liberty, that we've talked about before, The Life of the World to Come, and collections of poetry, including Concertina, Land of Amnesia, The Feast of All Saints, Joe Bufanti. Thanks so much for coming back and visiting.
Oh,
we'll do it again.
My pleasure, and hello to everyone who's listening, and great gratitude, and Happy New Year. Take care.
Thanks again, Joe. Oh, that was great stuff.
Okay, bye-bye.
He's one of my faves.
Doesn't that just take you back to being out there with glove in hand and those old flannel uniforms?
And Mo Como on the mound in the sixth grade, 6'2", 192 pounds. I never saw the ball.
We've all had that experience, definitely. That was great. Joe Bufanti with us here on Sports Lit 101.